Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. As I'm reading this, the Super Bowl is tomorrow. And first off, I have an article about Super Bowl commercials because those are a pretty big thing too. Watch the best and the rest of Super Bowl 2025's star-studded commercials. Drew Barrymore, Vin Diesel, Charlie XCX, The Muppets, and more have some products they'd like to sell you. This is by Ryan Coleman. Real ones know that the Super Bowl is only as good as its halftime show, and the realists know that the halftime show is only as good as the star-studded commercials that play throughout the telecast. Oodles of ads set to air during Sunday's big game already dropped a few days early, meaning you can enjoy David Beckham's meeting his long-lost brother Dave, played by Matt Damon. Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal having a When Harry Met Sally reunion, and the Muppets wrecking havoc at a beachside hotel right now. Familiar faces from Super Bowl ads past have returned, like Nick Offerman, Mountain Dew last year, Pringles this year, and Eugene Levy, EQ Bank last year, Little Caesars Pizza this year. But we have some Super Bowl newbies too, like Tim Robinson and Shaboozy. Read on for the best and not so best of the 2025 Super Bowl star-studded commercials so far, and make sure to check back for updates during Sunday's big game. These are all starting with either best or rest, and the first one is a best, Catherine O'Hara and Willem Dafoe for Michelob Ultra. Anheuser-Busch is cranking out the ads across its brand portfolio this year, from Beckham and Damon for Stella Artois, to Post Malone and Shane Gillis and Peyton Manning for Bud Light, and best of all, Catherine O'Hara and Willem Dafoe for Michelob Ultra. The pair of beloved stars play undercover tennis phenoms who only use their gifts for good, absolutely wrecking actual professional athletes. Sabrina Ionescu, Randy Moss, and Ryan Krauser to get their coolers of ultras. In our rest category, Adam Brody, Nick Offerman, and James Harden for Pringles. Pringles uncaps another mustache-centric advert for turning Chris Pratt into the mustachioed Pringles mascot last year. For their 30-second spot this time around, Adam Brody makes a chilling discovery, an empty Pringles can. He's encouraged to blow into it like a magical conch. Lo and behold, mustaches from around the land belonging to Nick Offerman, basketball pro James Harden, and Kansas City Chiefs head coach Andy Reid come flocking to him. It'd be a great ad if it weren't for another far superior flying facial hair themed ad running during the game. Another best is Eugene and Sarah Levy for Little Caesars Pizza. Canadian treasures Eugene Levy and his daughter Sarah, best known for her role on her dad and brother's hit sitcom Schitt's Creek, have the upper hair, on the flying facial hair game this year. In this Little Caesars Pizza ad, the pure delight inspired by a sampling of the pizza chain's new Crazy Puffs causes Eugene's famously bushy eyebrows to take flight, leaving panic and confusion in their wake. Another best is Vin Diesel and Michelle Rodriguez and Ludacris for Häagen-Dazs. You don't turn your back on family, ever. Häagen-Dazs decided to get fast and furious this year with a rip-roaring commercial featuring Dom, played by Vin Diesel, Letty, played by Michelle Rodriguez, and Tej, played by Ludacris, themselves. Does this mean Tej survived the Fast 10 plane crash? In our rest category, it's Chris Pratt, Chris Hemsworth, and Chris Jenner for Ray-Ban Meta. Enough of the Chrises, especially if they aren't Pine or Evans. Mixing up the meme with Kris Jenner was clever, but not even the first momager herself could spice up this ad for Meta's collab with Ray-Ban. AI glasses? More like, ay caramba. Another rest category is Post Malone, Shane Gillis, and Peyton Manning for Bud Light. Posty is, by this point, an America treasure. And I've heard that distinguished former SNL host Peyton Manning is also a footballer of decent standing. But this collab with fellow SNL host and fired cast member Shane Gillis fails to launch. The canned, Deadpool-esque humor stares the viewer straight in the eyes, begging them to laugh, and the notably bro-y overtones suggest the brand is still overcorrecting for their shameful abandonment of trans influencer Dylan Mulvaney in 2023. Here's a best, Meg Ryan, Billy Crystal, and Sydney Sweeney for Hellman's. Finally, some good food. We'll take a When Harry Met Sally reunion in any way, shape, or form it comes, even if it's as a mayonnaise commercial. Hellman's brought together the stars of Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron's eternal 1989 rom-com to recreate the infamous Cat's Delicatessen scene. This time, all it takes is a generous dollop of mayo to send Ryan over the edge, with Sydney Sweeney delivering the zinger. I'll have what she's having. Another best is Sam Richardson and Tim Robinson for Totino's Pizza Rolls, two of TV's favorite goofballs and two real-life friends, Sam Richardson from Veep and Tim Robinson from I Think You Should Leave, join forces in this heartwarming commercial for Totina's Pizza Rolls that goes horribly wrong. A warm and snuggly ET-like alien getting crushed to death in front of his young bestie is only something the creative team behind the unceremoniously canceled cult sitcom Detroiters could come up with. And they did! In addition to stars Richardson and Robinson, the ad was written by Detroiters co-creator and writer Zach Kanin and directed by I Think You Should Leave's Alice Mathias. In our rest category, Gordon Ramsay and Pete Davidson for Hexclad Cookware. Yes, chef. Hexclad Cookware gives us another alien-themed joint with Kitchen Nightmares impresario Gordon Ramsay and SNL star Pete Davidson. The humor hinges on Pete Davidson looking like an alien? All famous people are aliens. The alien ambassador tells Ramsay, to which he deadpans, "I'm not." The pan looks top-notch, but the ad is not. For a best, it's David Beckham and Matt Damon for Stella Artois. Gratitude has to go to Stella Artois for reuniting David Beckham with the celebrity fans have been postulating for years could be his long-lost twin brother, Matt Damon? The humor in the cheeky Stella ad is in the preposterousness of Beckham and Damon sharing even an iota of genetic material, but it's Damon's exquisite performance that really sells it. Should there be an Oscar category for best performance in a Super Bowl commercial? For the rest category, we have Walton Goggins for GoDaddy. Admittedly, a product called Walton Goggins Goggle Glasses really catches the ear. And the Justified actor's bespoke line of sleek shades, which he teamed up with GoDaddy to advertise, do catch the eye. But the ad feels more like an internal brand activation video than the kind of silly, crazy, and kooky Super Bowl content we're looking for. A best is Shania Twain for Coffee Mate. The best thing about being a Super Bowl enjoyer is the prerogative to have a little fun. Don't squint your eyes too hard looking for Shania Twain and Coffee Mate's surreal new Super Bowl spot. It's mostly a dancing tongue, but you won't be able to miss Twain's instantly recognizable voice belting it out about the creamer's new cold foam product. As the wise ones once asked, so Twain echoes, "Have you ever seen a tongue do this?" A best is Seal and Becky G for Mountain Dew. If you like your commercials weird enough to leave lasting psychic scars on children, Mountain Dew is your brand this year. The hallucinogenic, at times nightmarish, Baja Blast ad features a singing seal with the singer Seal's face animated onto it, performing a soda-themed version of Kiss Like a Rose to Becky G. A volcano explodes, orcas do a synchronized dance, and I might have had a stroke. A rest category is Shaboozy for Nerds. Nerds are a consensus candy, and who doesn't love Shaboozy's Grammy-nominated A Bar Song, Tipsy? The cluster candy brand's new Super Bowl spot is unfortunately so overladen with gelatinous Technicolor CGI goo that one can barely make out the words to the country singer's rendition of What a Wonderful World for the ad. A best is the Muppets for Booking.com. This is our last one. The Muppets Forever. The creative team over at Booking.com demonstrated their genius vision by enlisting Kermit, Miss Piggy, Animal, Gonzo, and Statler and Waldorf in their latest ad. The Muppets ride on luggage carts, play banjo by the sea, and get into all manner of delightful hijinks. That is, watch the best and the rest of Super Bowl 2025's star-studded commercials. It was by Ryan Coleman, and every commercial that was just mentioned in the article is linked in there also. Since the Super Bowl is taking place in New Orleans, here are the 12 best New Orleans movies to watch ahead of the Super Bowl. From A Streetcar Named Desire to The Princess and the Frog, these movies get to the heart of Crescent City. This is by Mary Solosi and James Mercadante. Hollywood's love stories are often set in the Big Apple and the City of Angels, hell, even the Windy City. So it's always a little extra special when the Big Easy gets its moment on the silver screen. With its anthemic music, world-famous cuisine, vibrant architecture, and Mardi Gras revelry, New Orleans delivers a visual and thematic backdrop as hearty and flavorful as its famous gumbo. In honor of Hollywood South, here are 12 essential movies set in New Orleans. The first one is The Big Easy from 1987. Jim McBride's comedic neo-noir stars Dennis Quaid as a Cajun police officer and Ellen Barkin as a state DA whose paths cross when they investigate a murder. The comedy thriller is so steeped in the culture of its setting, featuring a NOLA-centric soundtrack and various iconic locations, that you can practically feel the Louisiana humidity, unless that's just steam coming off of the sizzling Central Romance. Our next movie is The Cincinnati Kid from 1965. The stakes are high in Norman Jewison's drama, which stars Steve McQueen as the kid of the film's title, a talented poker player in Depression-era New Orleans who seeks to take on the man, a reigning champion of the game played by Edward G. Robinson. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button was from 2008. The old magical city sets the stage for David Fincher's fantastical adaptation of F. Scott Fitzgerald's very curious short story about a man, played by Brad Pitt, who is born with the appearance of an older man and ages backward. As New Orleans and the love of Benjamin's life, Daisy, played by Cate Blanchett, ages and evolves, our hero becomes younger and younger. Girls Trip is from 2017. Your best friend's bachelorette has nothing on this girls trip. Malcolm D. Lee's raunchy summer smash follows four former BFFs who reunite for a wild weekend at NOLA's Essence Fest, where they sample the down-and-dirty delights of the city. The film presented a major breakout for Tiffany Haddish as the wildest quarter of the Flossy Posse, and ensured that nobody who ever saw it will ever look at a grapefruit the same way again. Hitman from 2023 is next. Richard Linklater's thriller comedy paints New Orleans as a murder-for-hire hotbed, where Glenn Powell stars as an NOPD tech rookie-turned-undercover agent who lures in would-be criminals by posing as various hitmen. The Crescent City's rich atmosphere elevates the film with a soundtrack filled with Louisiana legends like Jelly Roll Morton and Buckwheat Zydeco, plus iconic local haunts such as the Please You restaurant and Ted's Frost Top Diner. Interview with the Vampires from 1994. Neil Jordan's irresistible adaptation of Anne Rice's gothic classic stars Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, and an 11-year-old Kirsten Dunst as vampires who have spent centuries of their immortality in New Orleans, doomed to an eternity of being gorgeous, bloodthirsty creatures of the night. Pitt's Louis de Pont du Lac broods about it a whole lot, but there are definitely worse fates, right? Jezebel is from 1938. Betty Davis won Best Actress at the Oscars for starring in William Wyler's romantic drama about a headstrong Southern belle in post-Civil War New Orleans who destroys her own life by wearing a daring red dress instead of a demure white one. It's true. The dress code is no joke around there. King Creole is from 1958. Early in his film career, Elvis Presley took on the Crescent City as the star of Michael Curtiz's musical drama, for which the iconic performer had his military service deferred for 60 days, about a teenage singer in New Orleans who falls in with the wrong crowd. Number 9 of our list of 12, The Lovebirds from 2020. Nothing says couples therapy quite like being framed for murder. Gibran, played by Kumail Nanjiani, and Lilani, played by Issa Rae, put their breakup on hold when they land in the crosshairs of a blackmail scheme tied to Louisiana's political elite. As they race through New Orleans to unravel this conspiracy and clear their names, viewers get a madcap tour of the city, from the Mississippi riverfront to lively bars and its iconic heritage streetcars. New Orleans, from 1947. Though not considered a great classic, Arthur Lubin's musical romance, blossoming against the backdrop of the New Orleans blues scene, features Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong as characters who get together in its cast, which also includes a whole roster of jazz greats. With that kind of pedigree, who cares if the film itself isn't a masterpiece? The Princess and the Frog from 2009. Disney presented its long overdue first black princess with this interpretation of the Frog Prince set in New Orleans in the 1920s. Randy Newman composed the jazz, zydeco gospel, and R&B-infused soundtrack, which includes the legendary Dr. John on the introductory track Down in New Orleans for the fairy tale about a gumbo and beignet-making waitress who becomes a frog and then a princess via voodoo magic. And our number 12 of 12, A Streetcar Named Desire from 1951. Of the many adaptations of Tennessee Williams' many moody Southern dramas, the greatest has to be Elia Kazan's legendary film based on Williams' Pulitzer-winning play. Vivian Leigh stars as Blanche DuBois, a fading Southern belle who reaches a breaking point when she comes into contact with her violent brother-in-law, Stanley, played by a breathtaking Marlon Brando, reprising his role from the 1947 original Broadway production in New Orleans. That was the 12 best New Orleans movies to watch ahead of the Super Bowl, and it was by Mary Solosi and James Mercadante. The Critics' Choice Awards just recently happened, and here is the full winners list. Discover the critics' picks for the best films and TV series of the past year. This is by Ryan Coleman and Oliver Gethel. The critics have spoken. The 2025 Critics' Choice Awards handed out their honors with director Sean Baker's scrappy dramedy, Anora, taking the top film prize and FX's historical epic Shogun, emerging as a big winner in the TV categories. Hosted by comedian Chelsea Handler, back for her third stint, the ceremony aired live on E! From the Barker Hangar in Santa Monica, California. The event had been postponed twice due to the Los Angeles wildfires, and Handler opened the show paying tribute to the firefighters, the Red Cross, Habitat for Humanity volunteers, and others helping the city deal with the devastation. Heading into the evening, the splashy screen adaptation of the Broadway musical Wicked had tied the papal succession drama Conclave for the most nominations in the film categories, with 11 apiece. On the small screen, Shogun led the pack with 6 nods. We have all the winners here from the 30th Annual Critics' Choice Awards. And I'm just going to read the winner to keep the article short, but if you want to see everybody who was nominated, it's all here in the article. For Best Picture, the winner was Anora. The Best Actor was Adrien Brody for The Brutalist. Best Actress, Demi Moore for The Substance. Best Supporting Actor, Kieran Culkin for A Real Pain. And Best Supporting Actress, Zoe Saldana for Emilia Perez. Best Young Actor or Actress, that is Maisie Stella for My Old Ass. Best Acting Ensemble, Conclave. Best Director, John M. Chu for Wicked. Best Original Screenplay, Coralie Fargate for The Substance. Best Adapted Screenplay, Peter Strahan for Conclave. Best Cinematography, Jaron Blaschke for Nosferatu, and Best Production Design, Nathan Crowley and Lee Sandales for Wicked. Best Editing, Marco Costa for Challengers. Best Costume Design, Paul Traswell for Wicked. Best Hair and Makeup is Stephanie Guyon, Frederic Arguello, Pierre Oliver Persine for The Substance. Best Visual Effects, Paul Lambert, Stephen James, Rhys Salcombe, and Gerd Nefzer for Dune, Part 2. Best Animated Feature, The Wild Robot. Best Comedy, the winner is a tie of Real Pain and Deadpool and Wolverine. Best Foreign Language Film is Emilia Perez. Best Song is El Mal from Emilia Perez. Best Score is Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross for Challengers. Those were all the movie winners. For television, the best drama series was Shogun on FX and Hulu. Best Actor in a Drama Series, Hiroyuki Sanada for Shogun. And Best Actress in a Drama Series, Kathy Bates for Matlock. Best Supporting Actor in a Drama Series, Tadanobu Asano for Shogun. Best Supporting Actress in a Drama Series, Moeika Hoshi for Shogun. Best Comedy Series, the winner is Hacks. Best Actor in a Comedy Series is Adam Brody from Nobody Wants This on Netflix. Best Actress in a Comedy Series, Jean Smart for Hacks. Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series, Michael Urie in Shrinking. Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series, Hannah Einbinder in Hacks. And Best Limited Series, Baby Reindeer on Netflix. Best Movie Made for Television, Rebel Ridge on Netflix. Best Actor in a Limited Series or Movie Made for Television, Colin Farrell in The Penguin. That's on HBO Max. Best Actress in a Limited Series or Movie Made for Television is Kristen Milioti in The Penguin. Best Supporting Actor in a Limited Series or Movie Made for Television, Liev Schreiber in The Perfect Couple on Netflix. Best Supporting Actress in a Limited Series or Movie Made for Television, Jessica Gunning in Baby Reindeer. Best Foreign Language Series is Squid Game. Best Animated Series, X-Men 97 on Disney+. Best Talk Show, the winner is John Mulaney Presents, Everybody's in L.A. That's on Netflix. And for Best Comedy Special, our last category, Ali Wong, Single Lady on Netflix. So I edited there by just mentioning the winners, and I am always interested in the other nominees because maybe those are things that I should be checking out. And they're all listed there on the article, 2025 Critics' Choice Awards. See the full winners list. That was by Ryan Coleman and Oliver Gettle. All of these are on Entertainment Weekly's website, and that's the show that you're listening to right now, Entertainment Weekly, here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading from this website, which is EW.com. Next, I have an article about a complete unknown, since it's nominated for the Oscar, a complete unknown director, James Mangold, breaks down what's fact versus fiction in Bob Dylan biopic. From musical festival violence to the pen pal bond between Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan, Mangold tells us what's real and what's not in A Complete Unknown. This is by Maureen Lee Linker. A musical biopic is never going to be completely true to life. When you're crafting a dramatic arc, certain things have to be invented, imagined, condensed, and so forth. That certainly holds true with A Complete Unknown, James Mangold's new biopic about Bob Dylan, played by Timothy Chalamet, that's in theaters. We didn't want to make a pseudo-documentary, Mangold tells Entertainment Weekly. We wanted to make a movie, so it wasn't like we're going to run around chasing the actors with handheld cameras. I wanted you to see what you couldn't in a documentary film, which was more intimate moments and moments in between the public moments. Indeed, Mangold points to plenty of excellent Dylan documentaries, if that's what someone wants, including No Direction Home and Don't Look Back. Still, while filmmakers might have to imagine dialogue of more private moments, they also try to rely on facts as much as possible. For that, they turn to archival footage, letters, and Mangold's own lengthy conversations with the artist, all of which infuse the film. A Complete Unknown follows a young Dylan as he first comes to New York to meet his hero, Woody Guthrie, played by Scoot McNairy. He also meets folk legend Pete Seeger, played by Edward Norton, and is propelled into the folk world, quickly rising as a singer-songwriter. In between a romance with Sylvie Russo, played by Elle Fanning, and dalliances with Joan Baez, played by Monica Barbaro, he becomes a superstar. But everything changes when Dylan decides he wants to go electric, abandoning the acoustic folk music that made him famous. Here, Mangold breaks down some major moments in the film and how much is drawn from real life. The first one is Bob Dylan travels to New York explicitly to meet Woody Guthrie and ends up crashing with Pete Seeger. This is true in spirit, if not in fact. Bob certainly arrived in New York and went to see Woody Guthrie, Mangold says. That was his whole goal. In fact, there was this beautiful object that Timothy found when he was doing research. He found a gentleman who collects Dylan paraphernalia. It was a record sleeve of a Woody Guthrie 78 record, on which Bob had drawn himself in pencil in the lower left corner holding a guitar case and a winding road up to the upper right of the record sleeve, in which was the picture of New York City. It says, Woody in NYC, and on the road there's a little sign that says, Bound for Glory, Mangold continues. It was done by a 17 or 18-year-old Bob Dylan, already making his plan to trek all the way to New York to meet his hero. And I've left out the most important thing. In the lower right of the record were the first stanza of the lyrics of the song for Woody. In the film, Dylan specifically seeks Guthrie out to play him this song, and it's this that impresses both Guthrie and Seeger and leads them to think that Dylan could be a powerful force in folk music. This is an invention, as Dylan did not first meet Guthrie at the hospital nor Seeger at Guthrie's bedside. Additionally, Dylan did frequently couch surf in his early days in New York, but it's unclear if he actually ever crashed at Seeger's house. For Mangold, it was more about the metaphorical role of the folk icon played at the beginning of Dylan's career. Pete Seeger served as a shelter against the storm for Bob, notes Mangold. From his first days in New York, Bob Dylan resisted being classified as a quote-unquote folk artist. As Seeger drives Dylan home from Guthrie's hospital, he asks him about his taste in music. Dylan tells him that he likes a bit of everything, including Johnny Cash and Buddy Holly. I don't think of myself as a folk musician, he tells Seeger. While we don't know if this conversation happened, it is true to Seeger's beliefs about music, and Dylan's dialogue is lifted from a radio interview he gave. Pete Seeger definitely was an evangelist for folk music, Mangold notes, with a young musician who he saw having such immense talents as a folk singer. He wanted to know whether they were on the same team and saw things the same way. Bob, from the very beginning, resisted all categorization, the director adds. In fact, a large part of his dialogue in that scene comes from an extremely early radio interview he did in 1962. That whole part where he is like, I'm not saying I'm a folk singer. I mean, I do sing folk songs, but not exactly. That entire thing is verbatim Bob Dylan dialogue. Sylvia Russo was Dylan's first great love. Yes and no. As has been noted elsewhere, Russo is based on Suze Rotolo, Dylan's first love and the woman who appears with him on the cover of his star-making The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan album. Rotolo is well known to Dylan fans, and she even wrote a memoir about her relationship with the artist, A Freewheelin' Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s. The memoir came out in 2009, and Rotolo died in 2011 at only 67 years old. Until her memoir, Rotolo had maintained a strict privacy about her memories of her time with Dylan. In keeping with that, and in honor of her memory, Dylan had one request for the filmmakers, that they change Rotolo's name because she was and remained a private person rather than a public artist. Indeed, both her memoir and the film indicate that it was Dylan's ever-increasing fame that doomed their romance. At a Q&A following a screening of the film, Mangold explained that he got the sense that Dylan made this request because the relationship is sacred to him. Mangold further expounded on the request to Entertainment Weekly, saying, I only know the reasons Bob told me. It seemed to me that I'd already won the trifecta in terms of him giving me permission to make so much of the movie that he had this one personal request about someone who'd already passed on. The one thing I felt from him on those conversations is tremendous warmth and affection for her, the director adds. While his relationships were more complicated with everyone else, I sensed that this was one where there was just tremendous fondness and gratitude for their young life together. Bob and Sylvie saw Now Voyager on their first date. Bob was a film buff, but it was an invention, Mangold admits, of his pivotal romantic scene. I chose that movie because it brought up the topic of someone reinventing themselves and restarting their life and rebuilding themselves anew, which I thought was a really interesting thing to raise between Sylvie and Bob early on. And to see Bob's slight sensitivity about the question about this since he was busy reinventing himself at the moment. However, Mangold says he also wanted to include this scene because of how much of a cinephile Dylan is in real life. Dylan is really interested in movies, he notes. When I sat and talked with him four or five times for long periods, he knew my whole catalog of movies. I could refer to anything from Kurosawa films to Wim Wenders movies to other musical films. He always knew exactly what I was talking about. He clearly enjoys taking in all this stuff. Mangold notes, it's a through line he's found with rock and roll artists and songwriters, including Johnny Cash, when he made Walk the Line. The relationship of movies and rock and roll and singer-songwriters is really powerful, he notes. When Johnny Cash was just starting out at Sun Records, so much of his persona was based on what he had seen coming out of the actor's studio and this new, mumbling, naturalistic, sensual world of young actors who existed in a more real place than what had been done before. I certainly found that was true for Dylan as well, that he had taken tremendous inspiration from what he had seen at the cinema. Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan were longtime pen pals. This is 100% true. Mangold knew of the letters and makes passing mention of them when he made Walk the Line, but he didn't get to read them until he was prepping for A Complete Unknown. "I didn't know anyone had them," he explains. "I started working on writing this movie, and I called up Jeff Rosen, Bob's manager. I asked him, 'Do you have the letters that Johnny Cash wrote to Bob?' And he goes, 'Oh, yes.' So he sent them to me. Those words are exactly those letters. That correspondence comes from Bob's archives. The very specific line where Johnny says, 'Bob, track some mud on the carpet.' That's literally what Johnny said to Bob in the letters." However, it must be noted that Cash didn't perform directly before Dylan at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival, as depicted in the film. He did play prior to Baez, but Dylan didn't perform his set until 2 days later. Bob Dylan made an appearance on Pete Seeger's TV show. As far as we can tell, this one is entirely fiction. Seeger did have a long-running show, Rainbow Quest, that aired in New York and New Jersey and existed to feature folk, blues, and bluegrass musicians. But it doesn't seem that Dylan ever made an appearance on the show, as he does in the film, showing up late to the planned segment. The scene was already in the script that Jay Cox wrote when Mangold came onto the project. "Pete had the show, and only some of the tapes of the show exist anymore," he explains. "It was a fabulous show, but I'm not sure Bob was on it." Furthermore, Seeger's guest on this show, Jesse Moffitt, is entirely an invention. No such blues guitarist existed. Bob Dylan refused to play Blowin' in the Wind while touring with Joan Baez. Many of the details of this tour are hazy, so we can't be sure if this onstage fight between the two paramours happened. However, it is representative of the numerous accounts of Dylan's general disinterest in playing the folk hits that made him a star by 1965. There was a point of transition when he was in the studio where he was reluctant or resistant to playing it, Mangold notes. It would be like someone asking to play the greatest hits and he was trying to move on to something new. A lot of that dialogue was also taken from Dylan from a collage of other Dylan moments. Johnny Cash encouraged Bob Dylan to do an electric set at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival. While their correspondence indicates that Cash regularly encouraged Dylan to ignore naysayers and remain true to his artistic instincts, the scene where an intoxicated Cash convinces Dylan to go through with the set is pure fiction. In fact, according to the lineup, Cash wasn't even at the 1965 festival, or at least he never played a set at it. Johnny was encouraging Bob not to listen to the potentates of folk music in his letters, Mangold notes. Dylan did go back out and play two acoustic songs, Mr. Tambourine Man and It's All Over, Baby Blue. The film only shows him doing the latter on Johnny Cash's guitar. However, Cash was not backstage to hand it to him. In fact, Cash had given him the guitar at the 1964 festival the year prior as a gesture of admiration. The 1964 festival was the first time the two men met in person. Bob Dylan playing electric at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival brought the festival brass to blows. In the film, Dylan's determination to play electric at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival and his eventual actual performance ignites a firestorm within the folk world, with purists wanting to ban him from the stage. As the film builds to this climactic moment, it shows men like folk historian Albert Lomax, played by Norbert Leo Butz, practically coming to blows with Dylan and his team, and eventually Loman and Dylan's manager Albert Grossman, played by Dan Fogler, do get into a physical altercation backstage. But was the tribalism between folk and rock music actually this intense? In short answer, yes. People said they had never seen Pete Seeger so angry, Mangold says. The folk tale is that he grabbed an axe and tried to smash the mixing board. We didn't quite take it that far. It is a documented fact that Al Lomax and Albert Grossman got in a fist fight backstage during the concert. Those are not really dramatic inventions. Even Bob Dylan refers to that night as a fiasco. It was clearly a messy affair. Bob Dylan, this is our last one, Bob Dylan was booed and the audience threw things at him when he went electric. The film comes to its climax as Dylan and his band play three electric songs, including Like a Rolling Stone, to a mixed but largely hostile reaction from the crowd. Mangold played up the anger for dramatic effect, but he does note that the accounts of the night are so varied that it's difficult to parse what actually happened. There's very different testimony, he explains. There was testimony that there were bottles and programs being hurled at the stage. There were also some fans loving it. There were also some fans getting in fights with each other in the audience. The tribalism was real, and the threat was real. Mangold notes that one moment when a member of the audience screams at Dylan like he's a Judas was borrowed from another concert the following year. That came from a concert in Manchester, England, he says, but it happened. It was just a concert a little while later. But if you see the documentary interviews from the Manchester concerts where he also went electric, you can feel the hot rage from these Dylan fans who feel utterly betrayed that he's moved in this new direction. There you have it, a complete unknown director, James Mangold, breaks down what's fact versus fiction in the Bob Dylan biopic. And it was by Maureen Lee Lanker. Here's an article about Ted Lasso. Juno Temple knows who Keeley ends up with at the end of Ted Lasso. The actress is sitting down at the table and putting an end to the Roy-Jamie debate once and for all. This is by Emlyn Travis. It's the burning question that has continued to plague Ted Lasso fans ever since season 3 ended. Who exactly does Keeley, played by Juno Temple, choose in the end? As longtime AFC Richmond supporters will remember, the emotional finale saw bloodied buddies Roy Kent, played by Brett Goldstein, and Jamie Tart, played by Phil Dunster, march up to Keeley's door and demand that she pick one of them to date. Their plan naturally blows up in their faces, with an insulted Keeley choosing herself and kicking the pair out of her home. Now, Temple tells Entertainment Weekly who she believes Keeley would choose between the pair of football pros. "I think, ultimately, she ends up with Roy," she reveals over Zoom. "But, at the same time, I will say that working with both of those men, Phil and Brett, they are such extraordinary humans. And I think the journey of both of their characters throughout all three seasons is a quiet masterclass in acting." She continued, "I think she would probably have a great time ending up with either one of them, but my gut tells me that it would probably be Roy." Keeley and Jamie dated throughout the first season of Ted Lasso before she ultimately broke up with the hotshot footballer because he was being an objectively bad boyfriend. She found love again with the curmudgeonly team captain Roy in season 2, but it was revealed in the first episode of the third season that they, too, had hit a rough patch and went their separate ways. That same season, Keeley also had a brief romance with her company's billionaire investor Jack, played by Jodie Balfour, but the pair weren't a perfect match either. Instead, Keeley invested in herself, finding success as part of KBPR, Keeley and Barbara Public Relations, and submitting a proposal to Rebecca, played by Hannah Waddingham, to spearhead AFC Richmond's Women's Football Club. Still, there's some hope that Ted Lasso fans will be able to see Keeley and Roy's romantic on-screen reunion someday. Temple reveals that she's heard cogs are moving on a potential season 4, despite star and co-creator Jason Sudeikis previously stating that the story had reached its planned conclusion. For now, Temple is bringing a bit of the show's inspirational energy into her and Miles Garrett's new Oikos Super Bowl commercial. The ad, that can be watched from within this article, features Temple heroically carrying an injured Garrett through the airport on her shoulders to help him catch his flight. Garrett, in return, holds onto her yogurt so that she can enjoy the rest of her snack on the walk back to her gate. Temple offers nothing but praise for her scene partner. "I've never met a football player before, and he's obviously one of the greatest defensive players ever," she says of the Cleveland Browns defensive end. "As great as he is at what he does, he is as great of a person. He's such a lovely human and was always just really fun to hang out with." The pair also shot the commercial in a real airport, which in itself created a whole host of hilarious moments. There was some moments of people paying attention to what you're doing and you're like, "I know, this looks really weird. Don't worry about it," Temple laughs. And then if you wanted to go outside, you had to go and come back through security. "I hate airport security. It makes me so anxious. But honestly, I also really enjoyed the airport aspect of it." That was Juno Temple knows who Keeley ends up with at the end of Ted Lasso, and it was by Emlyn Travis. Also coming up in our future is another Knives Out mystery. This is Hallelujah, the first look and clue at Wake Up, Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery, is officially here. Daniel Craig and Josh O'Connor go to church. This is by Lauren Huff. Can I get an amen? The game is afoot again, sleuths. Netflix revealed the first look and therefore the first potential clue at the upcoming Wake Up, Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. The photo that's featured in the article features Daniel Craig once more reprising the role of Detective Benoit Blanc, bonkers, Cajun accent and all, and franchise newcomer and possible suspect Josh O'Connor in church. With stained glass behind them, the two stand between dark wooden pews, peering at something or someone just out of frame. So far, details on the third Knives Out film from writer-director Rian Johnson have been scant, besides word of its release on Netflix sometime this fall. A logline for the film simply states, "Benoit Blanc returns for his most dangerous case yet." But in a previous post on social media, Johnson teased, "We're about to go into production on the third one, and I'm very, very excited to share the title," which gives a little hint of where it's going. Each of the past film's titles taken from popular rock songs has contained clues to the direction of the story. In this case, Wake Up, Dead Man shares its title with a song by U2 from their 1997 album Pop. In the song, Bono makes an emotional plea for Jesus to return and save humanity from itself. There's even some hint of yearning for an apocalyptic event to give the world a do-over. Furthering the religious theme, the video announcing the film's title used a gothic black letter typeface commonly found in Bibles from the 16th and 17th centuries. The clip also showcased a coffin in its imagery, and the final sound heard was the tolling of a church bell. Given these clues, it's not entirely surprising that today's first look takes place in a church. As far as suspects go, Netflix has revealed that the mystery will feature this murderer's row of stars: Glenn Close, Josh Brolin, Mila Kunis, Jeremy Renner, Kerry Washington, Andrew Scott, Kaylee Spaney, Daryl McCormick, and Thomas Hayden Church. Johnson's trilogy of whodunits began with the starry 2019 box office hit Knives Out, which first introduced Benoit Blanc as he sought to solve the murder of renowned crime novelist Harlan Thrombey, played by Christopher Plummer. Following its success, Netflix struck a massive deal north of $400 million to develop sequels. Glass Onion, from 2022, then brought the investigator to the private island of tech billionaire Miles Braun, played by Edward Norton, where someone at their murder mystery party wound up dead. That is Hallelujah, First Look, and Clue at Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery is officially here. That was by Lauren Huff. We have another first look, Karate Kid Legends. Exclusive first look unites Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio around the next generation. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Ben Wang first fell in love with the Karate Kid franchise at a movie theater in 2010, watching Jaden Smith's Dre Parker practice jacket on, jacket off with his sensei, Mr. Han, played by Jackie Chan. I was the target audience when that movie came out. I was exactly the age of the character, Wang tells Entertainment Weekly. That whole movie takes place in Beijing, and I'd just come back from living for a year in Beijing. Also, I grew up watching Jackie Chan movies. He is the first memory I have of knowing what an actor is. It was all of my favorite things in one place. 13 years later, Sony announced a global casting search for a new Karate Kid who would co-star alongside Chan and OG Kid Ralph Macchio in a new film directed by Jonathan Entwistle. By that time, Wang already had a lead role on the martial arts-heavy Disney Plus series American Born Chinese and a working knowledge of Taekwondo, but he didn't immediately consider himself for the role. I thought, that's going to be awesome for whatever kid gets it, he recalls with a laugh. Humility aside, Wang beat out over 10,000 other wax-on, wax-off hopefuls to land the role of Karate Kid Legends Li Fong, a Beijing-based teenager who moves to New York City with his mother, played by Ming-Na Wen. The teen's transition to the Big Apple is, in a word, sour. Li has trouble fitting in his new school, and he keeps getting dragged into fights he would very much like to avoid. According to Sony's official plot synopsis, when a new friend needs his help, Li enters a karate competition, but his skills alone aren't enough. Li's kung fu teacher, Mr. Han, played by Jackie Chan, enlists original Karate Kid Daniel LaRusso, played by Ralph Macchio, for help, and Li learns a new way to fight, merging their two styles into one for the ultimate martial arts showdown. But how does Mr. Han know about Daniel LaRusso? Where does Mr. Miyagi, the late Pat Morita, fit into the story? And what's the connection between Legends and Netflix's Cobra Kai? EW pummeled Wang and Entwistle for answers. Politely, of course. And Entertainment Weekly wonders when Jonathan got involved in the project, and he says, well, I was originally sent the script in early 2022. It had all the pieces in it for Ben's character Lee, but it had a very different ending. One of the things that was really exciting to me when I first read it was this idea of connecting Jackie Chan's character of Mr. Han with Daniel LaRusso, both from the movies and then subsequently what his character had become with Cobra Kai. When I first read the script, Cobra Kai was nowhere near as far along as it is now. It all germinated at kind of the same time. And Entertainment Weekly asks Ben about his audition tape. Did you show off any martial arts skill in that video? Ben says, I did do martial arts. I was actually visiting my mom in China at the time. My mom worked in the countryside in this school in a rural province, and I got the email on my phone. They were like, they want to see you do some martial arts. So I made the tape in the gymnasium of her school. I don't know if you guys ever looked at that and went, where the hell is he? And the director says, when we first saw Ben's tape, we were like, wow, this kid is in rural China. We found this guy who's in the middle of nowhere. Wow, this is amazing. Only to find out that he's from Minnesota. But That also helped because Ben could fluently understand the Mandarin and the American side of what the story was all about. I'm editing this some for length, where they ask how would they describe Jackie Chan's presence on set, and the director says, apart from being a wonderful human being who is very warm, he is the type of actor that does not leave. When his day is done, you would often find him sitting next to me, sitting next to the DP, telling stories, talking to the actors. Jackie Chan is a movie star, and that is something that you don't see so much anymore. He had the ability to come up with a tiny idea that I never thought of, and all of Jackie's tiny ideas are in the movie. He was like the magical Dumbledore to us on set, and he's like that in the movie too. Can you give us an example of one of his tiny ideas? There's a wonderful fight sequence in the movie, which I'm not going to spoil, and Jackie had the idea to jump out at Ben from a random corner of the space without Ben even knowing where he was going to be. He wanted to jump out from the spot that would have the most effect. He was always looking for an opportunity to either roll on the floor, roll over a table, jump off a staircase. He would just be like, I will do this. None of us ever had a choice. It was like Jackie would have an idea and we just filmed it because it's Jackie, and it would always be awesome. What else can you tell us about how Karate Kid Legends connects to the world of Cobra Kai? The director says, I have always been a huge fan of Cobra Kai right from the beginning, and that's one of the reasons I thought this was such an exciting project. I was excited about the idea that the films and the series can all be part of one family. I've had some really detailed conversations with the Cobra Kai team about just cool stuff that we can do in the movie and can make this whole thing feel holistic, and obviously, Ralph is really, really close to it after all those years on Cobra Kai, and they've been involved in little steps along the way. Cobra Kai Legends premieres in theaters Friday, May 30th this year, and that was an edited version of Karate Kid Legends' exclusive first look unites Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio around the next generation. It was by Kristen Baldwin, and I edited it for length because I am out of time for Entertainment Weekly this week. Thank you all for listening. Please come back next week to hear what I found from their website, which is EW.com. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And until next time, goodbye.